Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. It's our last day of Denkwe Sesshin. It's gathering of light. We're each composed of light, and we come together in silence during this Sesshin. And what's interesting in Sesshin is that in silence, we don't really know who we're with very well. You know, we might know their name, who we sit next to. And yet, the time we spend together does something magical, which there's a really deep trust that that forms, and that trust helps the deepening of trust within us of to meet what is before us. So Denkwe has this culminates the Sesshin, this talk, and it also announces the beginning of a practice period for here at Jokoji and Zenkei Sangha. And the head of practice is called Shuso. And our Shuso for practice period is Senshin Ben Myers. And so, Ben, thank you for joining us today. And thank you for your willingness to lead this practice period. And it will begin probably a week from tomorrow with a study from 6 to 7 online. And we'll have evidence of that on our website. So I want to also thank Chiazan Sensei for joining us here, joining me in this sitting here and bringing the strong practice from Sokukoji, thank you. Too many syllables for me. But just profound practice that your teacher, who I know as Bob Brown, has so exquisitely developed, and it's been a huge influence on just this Sesshin and the practice that we do here. So thank you, Chizum, for joining us and bringing the the Lankavatara Sutra that we've had a chance to examine during Sesshin.
Thank you. Okay. I'd also like to extend my thanks to the entire Jokojiji. Jokoji Sangha. I've had just a tremendous time this week playing with Doug, having serious discussions with Doug, just enjoying company. And I also would like to thank my teacher, Sokuzan Hojo-sama, who is joining us today. And a lot of you heard a lot of stories about Sokuzan and expressed a lot of gratitude toward me, which I can only extend to what I've received from my teacher and from this incredible lineage. And this morning, as Doug said, we're finishing up Denkwe Sesshin, which means transmission of light. And so for our retreat this year, we were looking at this text called the Lankavatara Sutra. And it's a really appropriate text because this is said to contain everything one needs to know about Zen Buddhism, in about 300 pages. But the essence of the teaching, which is what I'd like to talk about a little bit, because the concepts are very difficult. They're very out there. They're elaborate and complicated. But as the translator Red Pine said, the essence of the teaching of the Lankavatara Sutra is to make a cup of tea and to taste it. And this is, as I understand it, the essence of Zen, that underneath, I don't know, tens of thousands of words in this text, maybe more, the Buddha is encouraging us to taste for ourselves. The text, in a sense, is self-defeating because it tells us all of these are projection words. All of these are just ideas and concepts, but they point to something profound. They point directly at the undifferentiated mind. And so instead of talking about these elaborate concepts, to consider what it is to make a cup of tea and taste it through our practice. And that's the incredible thing about Zen, is it does not require a PhD to practice. It does not require you to conform to something that is higher than oneself. That we have practices, we have forms, we have teachers, we have altars, but unless those are used to see deeper, it's just more emptiness, and not in a profound way, in just a dull way. It's imitation, it's artificial, it's brittle. And Zen is intimate. It is tasting. And so if we start out with the first part of that, to make a cup of tea, there's some slippery aspects to that. And when I was thinking about that phrase, what showed up for me is the tea has already been made. That when we come to Zen practice, the tea has already been made. We don't need to come to practice with the idea that we need to now acquire the tea, that we need to put a bunch of things together that look like tea, but to sit down through the practice of meditation and directly taste what is arising in all the sense fields as it arises. And that's discouraging, because when we sit down to meditate, we see everything we've been trying to change. And the impulse is to try to start adding ingredients to complicate the recipe for tea through our ideas and our idealism and our prejudice and our opinions. But to taste the tea as it's presented to us, the way my teacher has said this is, don't confuse your life. That when we sit down to meditate, we're not creating something. It is arising. It is arising as smell, as taste, as touch, as sound. It is arising as thoughts and emotions. And all we need to do is taste that, not get rid of it through aggression or hatred or preference for something else. We don't need to come to further intellectual understandings, which their nature is. You come to the intellect and it changes. It's impermanent. It's constantly shifting. So to replace one idea with another idea, it's kind of just prolonging, waiting longer to taste the tea. And we don't need to look for something else. We're inspired to try to find something that's beautiful and profound instead of appreciating our very unique cup of tea that is in front of us moment by moment by moment. And so we practice receiving. We practice receiving when we want something different. We practice receiving when we have something wonderful and it starts to change. And so the practice of Zen is not about getting a hold of the content of the mind. It's about tasting the mind precisely as it is arising. And it takes time and it's painful a little bit. We had a nice session this morning in the small zendo talking about meditation. And that as you begin to sit down and train the mind, it might get worse. And in all actuality, probably, it probably will, because we have years of creating defenses and ways to mitigate and not experience and not receive, that when we sit down to meditate, those defenses become weaker and we start to feel more deeply, and the impulse is to run away. The impulse is, I'm not meditating correctly, that if I was meditating correctly, I would have a very serene demeanor. Nothing would bother me. Meditation would be enjoyable. And instead, we're confronted with the actuality of what's spinning in our mind constantly, but in the stillness of Zazen becomes apparent. So I did my best to not discourage those learning to meditate by inviting them to feel what is showing up, to taste their tea as it arises. And it's not a quick process. I've been studying with Sokuzan Hojo-sama for 10 years, and I still have plenty of difficult lessons arising on a pretty regular basis. But instead of seeing over the time studying with him and the monks here, Jiuzan, Senshu, Byun, all living at the monastery, there's a number of the Sokokojiites online, is that I don't know anyone who lives there of the 15 monks that live at Sokokoji that would tell you, yeah, I don't really have negativity arising anymore. But you might find people that could talk about how their relationship and the struggle is not so intense. Kind of a willingness to feel, a willingness to have negativity, be sincere. And the teaching Doug gave us earlier this week was, sometimes it's enough to just show up. Sometimes it's enough to just be present. And that doesn't have to exclude how you feel. It doesn't have to exclude anything. And that's the Lankavatara Sutra. And that is all Zen literature. The invitation with the support of the three jewels, with the support of the concepts, with the support of the Sangha, the Buddha, the Dharma, the teacher, with the support to see for ourselves what is being pointed at beyond ideas, beyond forms, beyond images, and yet, as it's talked about, is completely present within those, that idea of not being separate. So perhaps it's not what we think it is, but it's also not other than we think it is. It's maybe not what we think it is, anger, but it isn't different. So we see that for ourselves. And I really appreciate the space Doug has created here for our practice, because it's important to see that there's a lot of communities doing a lot of different things, and they're all supportive. And instead of asking me to conform to the Jokoji style, which is beautiful and soft and warm and inviting, that he invited us to show up as Sokokoji, as another sister temple aspect of this lineage that we received from Koban Shino Roshi. And also the influence my teacher had from his time with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche for nearly 15 years. So in that vein, being this is the last time we may be here for a little while, but as we said, we might leave somebody. I was joking. They have to come back. We need them. I would just like to invite and ask and see that for the benefit of everybody, if there's questions you might have about this profoundly simple and yet difficult practice, this profoundly direct practice of tasting tea, and yet in the midst of our ideas, how often we turn away from it. So are there any questions that anyone would like to ask in regards to these teachings, the practice of meditation, Zen?
Jiuzan. Can you say what it looks like for our relationship to negativity to change?
That negativity which we personalize. I use anger, and I think that's a really good theme for this week, because Doug and I think we share some similar intensity, or we have shared some similar intensity in the past. And at first, it's justified. At first, we say, the cause of my anger is this, is you, is this situation. If they just hadn't, I wouldn't be angry. You need to change. And relatively, sometimes there's something to that. You know, people say things that are hurtful, or they act in such a way that causes harm. But again, as Sokozan says, nobody can dump a bucket of emotions into you. It is arising right here, and it may feel good to blame somebody, or you might feel justified when somebody apologizes. But on its most basic level, that is an aspect of our consciousness we need to examine. So then we begin to take responsibility for the negativity. And what was the gist of the question again?
What does it look like for our relationship to negativity to change?
So as I understand it, the anger doesn't have to change. The intensity doesn't have to change. But when we stop creating the story to personalize it, or we begin to soften up, or begin to see that the story is another layer of lamination, that instead of the anger getting its hooks into us and kind of using us like a puppet, that it's completely present, and yet we are able to see it clearly enough to continue to function. And Doug and I were talking last night, is if one were to completely get rid of all negativity, just lived out in a blissful state, it wouldn't always be particularly supportive to the student, because the teacher would just be saying, well, you just got to get rid of it. You just got to not have those feelings anymore. But there's something in Buddhism called skillful means, or upaya. And skillful means, to me, means that by whatever means necessary, a teacher will endeavor to help the students see the truth for themselves. And sometimes that has to include anger, the teachings of, that can be ferocious. And sometimes it has to include teachings of sadness or of compassion and softness. So if a teacher's gotten rid of all of that, it's not available to help the student. So I think similarly, that reminder that you and I receive on a weekly basis, if you don't have to get rid of anything, you don't have to get rid of anything, but you do need to see it very clearly. And in a sense, as practitioners of meditation, there should be a little sense of relief in that. That when you sit down to meditate, just because the mind shows up like a whirlwind, it doesn't mean we're bad meditators. It means we're actually looking at the mind. That when you sit down to meditate, knowing that you don't have to get rid of anything, you can kind of take your seat a little more thoroughly. You can actually just begin to receive without needing to discriminate what it is you are receiving. So I don't understand the content to refine, but the demands we make may begin to soften. Hogan.
Thanks for distilling that sutra down to something so concrete and simple sounding. I'm recalling you said it was make a cup of tea, then taste the tea. And I appreciate your invitation and reminder. First of all, taste the tea, to get out of the way, just taste the moment, taste where we are. But the first part, make a cup of tea, what if that's reminding us that we do have intent, we do have effort? Can you speak to those two things, intent and effort?
I can, because intention is that's another daily thing we probably hear about at Soka Koji, that Sokozan is always saying it's the intention that's important. All you need to do is intend. What I think can be difficult is that we don't feel secure in just having the intention. We have an intention to be kind. We have an intention to traverse the path. The way the ego likes to appropriate that is when our intention doesn't come to fruition. We think something wrong has happened. And I think that's some of the softness on the path. And I talked with several people about kind of this marriage of the masculine and the feminine. The masculine and the feminine both having to be present on the path. And the intention is a softness. It's an intention where we are endeavoring to be with all things. We are endeavoring to be kind. But it is not necessary to add the aggression of I didn't accomplish. We just return. And that's something that any one of us could remember, to return, to just show up, to return to the zendo is enough. To return to our intention is enough. And that we don't need to look for results. That's kind of the trap. Because as I understand it, this doesn't culminate in a concrete result. It doesn't culminate in like, oh, now I have this thing, which is realization or understanding. It's very fluid. It's very situational. The teachings remind us constantly how they have to manifest in different ways. So I would say, yes, making a cup of tea may be the intention on the path. It may be the vow on the path. But I would say that you can drink it as an intention and you don't have to wait for it to become fruition as we think about it to taste the tea.
Thank you.
Karin?
Would you say a bit more about intention? What is intention? And is it something that is within us? Is it something that arises within us? Is it something that is related to intuition? Or is it something that not necessarily arises, but we develop and we create? So could you say about intention, how it is related to my practice?
Let me ask you a question. You've been practicing for a little while now, meditating, studying the tea ceremony with Jiro. What was your original intention in coming to a situation like this and everything that there is to do in California, which is a lot? What was your intention that brought you to this?
To Jikoji.
To Jikoji and to practice.
I think the most one was like understand what is real, what is truth, what is going on.
Perfect. And it's, to me, that's what we return to, is that sometimes the forms of Buddhism can become very elaborate and the concepts can become very elaborate. But to return to the original intention, to understand for oneself. And why I think the intention is so important, as it is, as just that intention, that endeavor, is that it can become complicated when we start to formulate ideas about how that evolves. So the intention to see the truth, to understand. And because we want something to grasp at, we start to create ideas of what we think it is. What we think it is, and they become more polished and more shiny. And we start to hold on to it, and then we start to defend our path and our practice, and we start to argue with others. But we're arguing over recipes. It's like, my recipe is better than your recipe. I haven't tasted it yet, but I'm ready to fight you for it. And so returning to that original intention, I think, helps us continue to receive, continue to be students, to be curious, to consider what is arising, because until we have tasted it for ourselves, we endeavor as best as we can to receive whatever shows up, even when it's in contrast to what we think it might be or should be. Is that along the lines of what you were asking?
Yes.
Thank you, Karin. Mike?
Yeah, I just can't help thinking that you're talking about intention. You know, the dual proverb, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
How is an intention different from an action?
How is intention different from an action?
I mean, intention sounds like, okay, I intend to do this, but it doesn't say I did this, or I intend to be kind, but what's my action?
So the intention is important because it brings the awareness to the situation so that you're not acting out of standards. You're not creating a standard of appropriate and inappropriate action. And that's not to say that when we see something that is very clearly causing harm, that we don't step in and maybe abruptly or aggressively and stop it. But say you have the intention to train your mind. You sit down to meditate. There's your action. You're sitting down to meditate. There's no progression to check how you're doing in the sense of, I'm getting somewhere. It's the softness that just brings us back to the cushion over and over and over again. You intend to be kind, and sometimes you stick your foot in your mouth. It's not a matter of then going and beating yourself up. It's a matter of looking at that. What is that that feels that? Who is it that thinks it is the one who is acting or who has put their foot in their mouth? So I think there's a tremendous amount of openness, but there's a lot of fear on the path because it does not give us the kind of stability that belief provides us, or dogma or doctrine, or if we all could just agree on everything, that provides a type of temporary security. And the path is anything but secure because our very belief in identity, our very belief in who we think we are and what we think is happening is being challenged. Being invited to look at it in a different way. I feel personally, and this is my bias in this situation, two things. It requires a tremendous amount of meditation, a tremendous amount of looking at the mind, whether you're able to take some time away from your day-to-day life and attend sesshin, or you carve out a little time in the morning and the evening to practice. And I also feel very strongly that it's important that we have a guide. We have somebody, so our own ego isn't in the front seat driving the car of our spiritual path. And it's very rare to find a teacher who teaches out of what they see and not out of what they know, that teaches to the student and not trying to bring the student to them. And I feel very lucky that at a young age I found that. I found my teacher. And it was very difficult. I shared the story. Is Anton in here? Is he in the Tenzo cooking? I was trying to be a little funny yesterday, but Anton asked, what was your first experience of thusness? And I said, my first experience of thusness was 6'1" and wearing robes and slamming his hand on a table. And I feel that's very necessary to have a teacher who doesn't just allow you to keep spinning and say, yeah, you can have samsara, but is willing to step in there in a way that can be difficult because it challenges us. So I know you're working with Doug as a teacher, and I would say really consider what he says and ask questions and have a willingness to receive. It's a long practice. Other questions this morning? I know this is a bit of a different style than you're used to, and I appreciate you including me in it. Nora?
I want to thank you for the distinction about the tea having already been made. Because I think when we first sit down, we think we have to create that tea. We have to create that. We have to create that beautiful container of goodness, right? And stop being the fools that we are. And we sit and we're like, you know, waiting for it. And we stir, right? We spin and we kind of try to stir and make the tea and make it a better tea than it has been before. So that I will take that as a reminder when I sit and spin and stir and look for, like, you know, a better Nora or less troubled or whatever, you know, it is I'm looking for, and just realizing the tea has already been made, so I can stop the doing and I can just come into being and tasting it and experiencing it.
That I would encourage you to make sure that we don't use the teachings as a replacement either. The spinning does not need to be stopped. The spinning does not need to be stopped and returned to another artificial location. That the clarity is present in the spinning. I like what you shared about the Bolshin Tov?
Bolshin Tov?
Could you say that again? It was...
That... the Bolshin Tov was a Jewish mystic, and he said that where a person's thought is, his entire mind and body is. Where a person's actions are, their entire body and mind is. And it's about being, we're totally present in that, in our actions, in our speech, and in our thought. We are present with it. And it takes us to divine realms. It takes us to hell realms that fast. And yet when we meet this moment, when we meet thusness, when we meet suchness, when we meet just this it is, I want to use something Giro said, which is that when we meet it, gratitude unfolds. So touching suchness is, you will know you have touched it when gratitude arises. Would you agree with that? And that suchness is not like realizing the entire universe in one moment. It might just be realizing the inconceivable thread, like in tasting a cup of tea, there is not only the taste of the tea, but of the cup and of the genealogy of all teas of all times that has come to what it is right there. I mean, all of that is there, and there can be, you can almost fall apart in that moment with gratitude. And we have touched it, but then we're back. We're back into, oh dear, something's amiss. We should go through this a lot of times, don't we?
what Sokazan says is, I'm giving the same talk over and over and over again, but you're not hearing me. So it's good to go over it. It's good to go over it. And maybe the Buddha has to hold up the flower a billion times before Mahakashyapa smiles. So it's good to hear it. Buddhism's not a path of accumulating. It's the path of, is if we can just taste one word or one phrase or one being, that it seems like that would just open everything. It's not like omniscience, you need to know every aspect of phenomena, but to see and taste just one thing. And I've mentioned this before, and I feel this way about my teacher. There's a Tibetan teacher who's still alive. His name is Dzongsar Khyentse Rinpoche. And he once said about his teacher, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, he said, just being with Khyentse Rinpoche is to receive the entirety of the Buddha's Dharma. And so that's not something we can just understand. It sounds nice, but maybe it gives us pause when we're fighting with something. Is what if I could taste this? I know Dogen said meditation is a practice of ease. Really? Really?
See, I wanted to note that your teacher's teacher and my teacher is here too.
Oh, yay.
Oh. Shoho, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Shoho-sama.
Where are you? In Iowa?
Oh, there I am. Can you hear me? Yeah, I'm just en route, staying at a friend's house. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, I wanted to just add to something you said. She's on about bias. I've been studying various biases before, and kind of to confirm what you said, there's actually a bias called a outcome bias. So rather than focusing on the intent of our actions, we habitually tend to judge an event or an experience by its outcome. We judge it by its outcome. We have a bias to judge it by its outcome. I think it's also called the historical error, where you kind of assume that something happened in history because this country lost the war and that country didn't lose the war. It has nothing to do with the actual intentions of the country. Same thing with our intentions. So at any rate, these people that study biases actually have a term for what you were talking about. It's called the outcome bias. So rather than being with our intention and actually assessing the value of the actual experience by the process and not by the result, is a kind of bias that we're all familiar with. So coming back to the sense of what is our intention, I think is a really, really important thing for us to remember. So thank you for bringing that up. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Shoho-sama. Any other questions this morning or anything?
Larry.
Thank you very much for what you have presented. And the question just occurred to me. What's the movement from self-awareness to self-complacency?
From self-awareness to
what's
self...
What's the trap between self-awareness and complacency?
When you think you have somewhere to stand.
But I don't know that if I'm complacent.
You don't, and that's why I think it's important to have a teacher or a community to continue to put you back into that. And that is the trapping of spirituality, is when we decide to be our own guide, all we're going to do is find the pieces we like that support our existing ideas, so you become complacent in spirituality. But that is why it's so difficult to have a teacher, because it's antagonistic. It hurts. It's irritating to have it pointed out that you're full of, there's Sokazan, there's children here, so I have to be very careful with what I say. And again, that's why we have the three jewels. That's why we have a community that does not have to be in consensus, but can function together. That's why we have the teachings that remind us that they are only pointing. And that's why we have a teacher to help us when we start to think that halfway up the mountain is good enough. It's comfortable. It's a nice view. I really like the story that, this is more just for fun, Sokazan shared a story. Kobun Chino Roshi and Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche were very close, as I understand it. And someone asked Trungpa Rinpoche what the Vajrayana was like, and he said it's like going up a mountain, going to the top. And somebody told Koban this and said, Koban, what is Zen? And Koban said, it's starting at the top of the mountain and going up.
Thank you. Shishen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. This is kind of a lighthearted, silly question, but does the type of tea matter?
The type of tea matter?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, it needs to be, what was the chrysanthemum orange tea you had? Jiro's tea. Jiro's tea, that if you haven't been through a tea ceremony with Jiro, that's making a cup of tea and tasting it while making a cup of tea and tasting it.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Where are we for? Yes, Emily.
Wondered about the intention bias or outcome bias that someone's talking about, and I wanted to really be clear about how when we set the intention, is that enough?
Here's my bias, and the teaching I receive is yes, yes. But there's also a lot of other parts that come together to support that intention, so it's not something you have to hold all by yourself. It's unique and it's intimate, but that is why I feel that something like Buddhism has come together. It's not that Buddhism is ultimate truth, but the 2,500 years of trial and error has brought us tools that can help us understand that. So I feel that yes, it is enough to set the intention, but then it should be done in the context of these forms that help us and help support that intention. So that it doesn't become self-complacency. Karn.
Can I add on the topic of self-complacency? It's kind of a oxymoron, but like what arose in me was that it is true that if you are on your own, you can get self-complacent, and the presence of a teacher and a sangha push you in the right direction so that you're like not high on your own supply, so kind of. But on the other hand, like I think there is something in us which when we are in touch with, we know it is true. And as an example, like I've been teaching dance class recently, and I tell the students in the class that, you know, like, I'm telling you that these moves are supposed to be done this way, but the real judge is how it feels. And if it feels good, then, like, you are in sync with symmetry, and, like, just trust that your feeling is right and work on that. And so with this idea of like getting, what is the, which is an excellent question, how does one move from self-awareness to self-complacency? And I think there is ultimately there is an awareness between these two states which tell us the answer. And they have to do with things like gratitude automatically flowing or love automatically emerging. And so although like the Sangha and the teacher helps us move in the right direction, but I feel there is something in us that is also a pointer, is also a light that can has the potential to guide us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Maybe one more. I have found failures to be a great teacher. Like I learned how to do things right by having done them wrong. Like walking, we do that to keep from falling, you know. And so I have found, I have learned to become grateful for my mistakes.
Go ahead.
Good morning. This is good stuff. Good stuff. Great sound bites. I like that. What brought you here? I think that'd be a good book. You know, for a community, like, what was your intention? What brought you to the temple, you know, to Zazen, to study the self? I think for me, it was, I just wanted to stop and be calm and just learn to just be a good person out there in the world, you know, where people do make you angry and you get frustrated and you're, you know, first, intention is to react. But with this teaching, it's like right thought, right speech, right action. So you're constantly putting yourself in check. And when things do arise and you need to reach out, it's always a phone call away to your teacher. And they're there, you know, and the community and the Zazen. And I find too that I don't just sit in the Zendo. I mean, like, I'm at the airport and my flight is detained and I'm flipping and it's like, okay, well, this is out of my control. I obviously can't go anywhere. I'm just gonna like sit here and wait for the bell, you know? Mm-hmm. So just thank you for this today and write some books.
Thank you for that. We still got 5-10 minutes. Yes.
We talked a lot about intentions, and I'm just wondering you, what your view is on intentions evolving. Is it, you know, what you just said make you think that my intentions even start meditating certainly were very different than my intentions are now. They were much more egoistic.
Much more what?
Egoistic.
Mm. Mm. Of course. What else could bring us onto the path? I do feel that while the content around the intention, there's still some sort of energy or inspiration to be on the path. And while the words around it may change, just like maybe you formally or informally take the bodhisattva vows, when we start out, it's perhaps a very simplistic understanding of compassion. And as it evolves, we realize how little we know. Something my teacher says to me in a tremendous amount of compassion is that you're not that important. When I start to try to take responsibility or force my way into be the one, you're not that important. So I do feel that our understanding of the intention is definitely going to evolve as we begin to see through some of the egoistic aspects of it. But there's still some sort of movement, there's still some sort of energy that draws us into the path. And I think on a very basic level, when pressed, no one can fully explain why they're on the path. Like you really can't fully articulate what it is that would get you to dedicate so much time to doing nothing. I appreciate you bringing that up. It's definitely something for all of us to consider, to contemplate. Thank you. Mike? After Mike, Randy, I'll have you. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Just really briefly, the intrigue you said, the negativity in your sangha is reduced. And we were talking about the negativity. Was he talking about internal negativity or negativity between people? Or?
I don't recall that. I apologize. I often have trouble remembering what I've said.
Interesting.
It not intentionally. I really apologize. I don't recall.
Okay. What was at the beginning? It was earlier. You said you don't have as much negativity anymore.
Oh, I do. I do.
You do what?
Plenty of negativity.
No, but your negativity is reduced in your sangha.
Oh.
Maybe I misheard it.
Perhaps I missaid it. I think if anything, it's the struggle with the negativity as it arises, like the aggression to get rid of it or to justify it, instead of just seeing it as it arises and there's still functional action and there's still like the communication you could say to somebody when you do that, that really hurts. It's very practical. You don't need to be a martyr on the path. But I don't think it's the complete, well, I just don't have any form of anger anymore. It's that you see the anger as it is an aspect of mind that we need to see more clearly instead of trying to get somebody to take responsibility for how we feel. Randy?
Yeah, just a couple things. First, the whole thing of self-complacency. I find that just getting older and my body going through what the body goes through when it gets older deals with that pretty well, self-complacency. So it's always changing that. And I don't like it sometimes, yeah, but I have to deal with it, you know, day by day. And some days aren't so bad and some days are. But the one word that you use at the very beginning that I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit is undifferentiated mind. And I think I know what it means, but I'd like to hear you just say a few things about it, if possible. I'm sure it's possible. But.
When I use that phrase, I'm just referencing the traditional Zen texts that talk about the realization as undifferentiated. That if we are setting something up against something else, we create and buy into that tension and that polarity. So what was your name again? What is it?
Rain.
Rain. So like Rain was bringing up aspects of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right intention. And it seems like in a relative sense, that can be very supportive. But if we set it up too strongly as right and wrong, we are just trying to get rid of one aspect of samsara for another. When the word that is used in Sanskrit is samyak. Samyak means complete speech, complete action. It's curious that all of us know it as right speech, right action, right mindfulness, right. And in actuality, that word translates as complete. Complete speech, complete action, complete intention. So I only conceptually understand it as so long as we are creating and reifying the polarity of our existence, of our relative experience, we will continue to walk in different versions of the same circle. Sometimes they're nicer and grassier, but it's still an aspect of samsara. So what it is exactly, perhaps you could say better than I could, but what it does for me is create the intention is when I think something is solid, I need to look closer at it. I need to examine it. I need to drink it as it shows up.
Could I ask on this undifferentiated use of that word, In imagining the word undifferentiated, it almost like how do you even meet what is before you if it's undifferentiated? So it might be worth bringing up the word discernment. Mm. Does that apply?
Well, I think the word I would say is it doesn't necessarily mean homogeneous. Like undifferentiated to me does not mean everything looks the same, that everything just becomes gray. Or everything becomes one in the sense of it disappears, but you more appreciate dependent origination, that you actually appreciate the incredible contrast and texture, but the additional lamination of value and of solidity may become more, become less substantial. So that's something for me. And we talked a little bit earlier this week about the five skandhas and the word, the Sanskrit word vidya, which is opposed to avidya. Avidya means ignorance. And vidya, as I've read it through Trungpa Rinpoche, it is intelligence, but it is not pieces differentiating themselves. It still has the energy and the color and the contrast, but it's no longer something taking credit for being green as opposed to something taking credit for being blue. And it's still an area that I'm looking at. I want to understand what that is. I want to see what's being pointed out for myself. So again, in the midst of all these words, in the midst of all these recipes and ways to make tea, the best thing we can do is sit down and see if we can't taste the tea beyond trying to get our experience to fit our concepts.
Like licking the pages of a cookbook.
Yeah. Sokazan often talks about eating a recipe. So you're not going to get satisfied eating a recipe.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Susan. Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yes, please, Susan.
If there's a moment.
Yes.
As I know it's late. I was very intrigued by that question of what brings us to Zen practice. And briefly, just recently, I heard about a 10-year-old daughter of a friend of ours who asked her mom, begged to go to church, and the family was not very interested in her going to church. And it made perfect sense to me that this 10-year-old is in touch with the longing, or she's tapping that sense of longing. And I think that that may be what brings us to our sanghas after, certainly for many of us, after a lifetime of several different practices. So it's not just the need for a sangha, it's a need to acknowledge that our whole lives have been on the path. And for some kids, I see it because I'm around kids professionally, I see that longing that's manifest in them very clearly. So they wander. We all wander. And for some of us, so we just saw at Santa Barbara Zen Center, we just saw a newcomer who was just completely relieved to find what he called like-minded people. So I've been wandering, and all these questions that seem to make sense to him with Zen. And then there's the groundlessness wherever we are with any teaching. But some of us may want to look back on, when did that start up? When did we first have that sense, for me, that sense of unity and emptiness and not having a context to understand it as a child? Thank you for your clarity today. And
in closing, I just want to again express my deepest gratitude to Doug. Just has been wonderful to be here and to share this practice and space with you, and begin to get to know each other's communities even deeper, mm-hmm. and that connection we have. And again, would like to also extend my deepest gratitude to my teacher, Sokazan Hojo-sama, for having us come out here to receive this type of training. So we'll be home soon, and we miss you guys.
I'm gonna ask Michael.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.